understand.
Welcome to Paradise in the Pines, a podcast about the people, places, and stories that make this the home of American golf. Brought to you by the Pinehurst Southern Pines Aberdeen Area Convention and Visitors Bureau.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to Paradise in the Pines. I'm Phil Wurz, President and CEO of the Pinehurst Southern Pines Aberdeen Area Convention and Visitors Bureau. We're joined today by Dr. Tom Dorsel. Tom is a professor emeritus of psychology, clinical sports psychologist, and author of the best-selling book, I've got it right here, The Mental Game, which was written in 2008. Currently works with golfers in both Hilton Head and Pinehurst. And Tom, first of all, it's a pleasure to meet you, and thanks for taking time to visit us in Paradise in the Pines.
Pleasure to be here.
It's interesting, just full disclosure, I'm a member of Pinehurst Country Club, and in the members' newsletter, they wrote a story that you were moving from, dual citizenship or dual residency, Hilton Head, and also moving to Pinehurst, North Carolina. You know, your background is impeccable. I mean, three books on golf psychology. We'll get into some of that. Over 100 feature articles in Golf Illustrated, Golf Magazine, Golf Week. You're on ESPN's Inside the PGA Tour. So I'm sure a lot of people are very familiar with Dr. Tom Dorsel. So Tom, talk about how you got into the golf industry. You also attended Notre Dame, Kentucky, and New Mexico. Impeccable background. Just talk about who you are and how you came to be into sports psychology.
Well, I started playing golf at age 10, and I read a first book on golf psychology by Peter Cranford, The Winning Touch in Golf. And I think you can still find it, and it was a great book. Hmm. Probably read that when I was about 14, 15, 16. And so that got me, I guess, interested in the psychological side, the mental game. I mean, actually, from a very young age, I struggled with the mental game. And so I wanted to find answers myself. So yeah. I was looking for
it. I think everybody does. Yeah.
And it doesn't happen. It happens early.
Yeah.
But anyway, I then became interested in psychology as a profession and majored in psychology at Notre Dame. Got my master's at Kentucky and PhD at the University of New Mexico. And when I started teaching, I would find myself coming up with examples for basic learning theory and stuff like that, stress management and things like that. And I'd always, first thing that popped into my head would be golf. Mm-hmm. You know, I had my best examples with golf. I mean, I tried not to force golf down their throats, you know, I often came up with those examples. And then when I was playing golf, I could have two ideas about psychology between the fifth green and the sixth tee, you know. And so I started jotting them down, and then I started writing about them. So the first entree into writing was with Golf Magazine back in 1978 or 79, something like that. I sent them a small book. And they said, well, we're not going to publish the book. We've gotten out of that business, but we'll publish your second chapter. Hmm. And that was my entree, really. From there, I was able to point to that, and I had something published in Golf Illustrated. Then I had something published in Golf Digest. Then Golf Week took me on for 4 years for monthly. I published for them. And then I went back to Golf Magazine, and they took me for 2 years. And then Golf Illustrated for 12 years. So I ended up writing between those three or four publications about 114, I counted one time, articles.
I would imagine because golf is such a mental game, you have endless content because as you hear the saying, you'll never perfect the game.
Yeah.
From Scottie Scheffler on down, I mean, it's never going to be perfected. Why is golf such a mental game? And obviously you've got a book that says golf, the mental game.
Well, I think unfortunately, you got a lot of time to think.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, other sports are more reactionary, and you know, but you have so much time to think. I mean, the closest I can think of might be a pitcher in baseball. You know, quarterback's got a little time to think, but basically he has to react too. Basketball is all reaction. It seems like foul shooting. Now, foul shooting comes very close to golf, and you often see the mental game enter into foul shooting. I remember seeing a guy, I think it was for North Carolina, probably 20 years ago, was the best foul shooter in the country, and he had two shots for the end of the game to win, I think, and he changed his routine.
Hmm.
I noticed that he would, like, dribble the ball twice and then shoot.
Yeah.
But this time he dribbled the ball twice, he stopped, And he dribbled it one more time, shot and missed. And I said, uh-oh. As soon as I saw him dribble it one more time, I thought, he's not going to make this.
Hmm.
You know, and you know, that reminds me of Greg Norman when he had the collapse on the back nine of the Masters. They said his routine was like 1 or 2 seconds longer on the back nine than it was on the front nine. And that could be enough to let the negative thoughts have room to creep in. You got to be like a machine. You got to have a tight routine in order to counter pressure and distraction and negative thoughts.
How much does confidence play into that? Because NBC made a big point a couple weeks ago with Xander Schauffele, and he talked about how he had self-affirmation, self-confidence, that he was playing well. He never, I wouldn't say never, but typically he gets to the final round and he has, you know, some I guess, confidence issues trying to complete 70. He's great, 54 holes, great. Gets to that 72, and he just can't finish the deal. Yeah, is that just a complete mental block, or he feels confident, but then he gets to the final round, and things seem to kind of unravel?
Well, I'm thinking three different things here. Let's see if I can keep them together. First of all, Clark Kellogg with the NCAA recently gave a perfect answer for where confidence comes from. It's what I've been saying for years and others before me. He said, He says first it's preparation and then production, performance. In other words, you have to be fully prepared, and then you have to be able to produce and perform. And then you'll have confidence. So many people think you get confidence before you have the good performance. It's somewhere out of some mystical thing will be put in your head, and then you come out and have a supernatural confidence that will give you performance that's over the top. And you know, that just reminds me, when people play in tournaments, you'd be lucky to play at your normal level. People think, I'm going to have some super performance because I'm in a tournament. No, mm-hmm. It's just the opposite. You'll be lucky to just perform normally if you can in there. But anyway, as far as Schauffele goes, now, all I would say is he apparently needs to come up with some way to prepare for the final round, to prepare for the whole 72-hole stretch, not... Something's lacking, I would think, in preparation there. Therefore, he's not quite getting the performance. Therefore, he's not building the confidence. The third thing I wanted to say here is that when I was at Notre Dame, I talked to most of the teams as a team. And then I handed out index cards, and I said, write down the one thing that would just resolve all your problems. You know, you would be a pro. You would be a superstar if you could resolve this one issue. And they all wrote it down anonymously. I collected all the cards. I had about 500 of them. And then I started sorting them out. And confidence was the most dominant one. I mean, it wasn't like half of them.
Yeah.
But if I stacked them up, it would have the biggest stack. They wanted confidence.
How much a part of it is being in the moment? You hear people say being in the moment, not thinking about... And this is me, and I'm on a much lower scale as an amateur golfer, but like I seem to play better when I don't think about it. I'm not thinking about technically how the swing is going to work, how I'm trying to come inside out, just trying to stay in the moment.
Well, you remind me, I got a call from one of my players the other day, and I said, I'm going into a tournament. Can you give me some kind of motivational message? You know, and so I said, all I would suggest to you is a simple game plan, and that game plan is... Put the ball in the middle of the fairway with your tee shot, okay? Put it in the middle of the green or at least somewhere up around the green. Put your next shot up around the hole. It doesn't have to be stiff. And then you got a chance at a par, and you're pretty much assured a bogey. Now, in the moment would be, if it works, fine. If it doesn't work, you still go to the next tee and you review your game plan and say, now I'm going to institute that game plan on this hole. And you, in other words, you rejuvenate or renew your game plan on each tee. And that's what I would call being in the moment. You don't worry about what happened. You don't let everybody says, let it go. Don't worry about it. I'm not sure how you do that either, other than focus on what you're going to do right now on this hole. Each hole has to become an independent task with the same game plan applied, whether it's the first, the 14th, or the 18th hole, no matter what you've done previously, and you certainly can't worry about what you're going to do going ahead.
Right. I think people would probably say Tiger Woods has the best mental approach. I don't know if you would agree with that, but you know, obviously has the great game, but could stay in the moment, achieve at a very high level. How does he compare with others that you've examined over the years as far as the mental approach to the game?
Well, he's phenomenal, you know, and so was Nicklaus, though. So was Palmer. I got a story about Palmer you might find interesting. But as far as Tiger Woods, I was thinking about that this morning, that, you know, he had a sports psychologist when he was a junior. And that guy caddied for him during his early years. And I don't know whatever happened to him. You know, he must have been very good to get Tiger started. Now, of course, Tiger then went with all other teachers and all other caddies. And that guy's long forgotten, except maybe he's having some stellar career out in California that I'm unaware of. But if he's listening in, I'd like to know who he is and see what he did and what's going on. Now, of course, you know, they said Earl Woods did a lot of Eastern stuff, I think, with him, maybe his mom, that got him into more of a zone type of thing, which we don't know how to get into the zone, but he seemed to be able to get into
often.
It. But a lot of those guys are good. I was going to just mention about Arnie. I had a friend, Jack Charlesworth, who was the best man in Arnie's brother's wedding. He was a good friend of Arnie's brother. So he was over at Arnie's house one day. When Arnie walked in, he said, "Oh, Jack, what are you doing?" And Jack said, "Well, I'm a psychologist." And Arnie said, "I'm a psychologist too." So apparently he felt like his mental game was pretty good. And of course it was.
You see players today and they've got, you know, they've got the sports psychologist, they've got the dietitian, they've got, you know, their whole entourage. Yeah. How much has that changed? I mean, from Arnie and Jack's day, I mean, you know, they didn't have the big entourage, but, you know, obviously the mental game carries through generations. So how much has it changed to the point now? Do you think these guys are just walking machines because they have all the different people that specialize in so many different things? They're probably thinking about way too many things.
Yeah, I certainly. Well, I've been doing this. First thing I did was in 1975. So in 25, that's going to be 50 years, you know, that I've been paying attention to sports psychology, contributing to it and so on. And I've seen it change so much. I mean, when I first started doing sports psychology, my psychology peers really were not interested at all. You know, you need to be out there getting grants and running animal studies and stuff like that. And I thought this was interesting. So I started, you know, doing a little dabbling in the publishing, like I said, but it was a sidelight. But back then, nobody knew what you were talking about. And also, let's see, wait a minute, I'm starting to lose it here. You said, oh, yeah, has it changed? Okay, has it changed? Well, I can remember like Johnny Miller saying, you know, Ernie's working with this guy and he's doing this stuff. And can you believe Ernie has, he couldn't even say the word psychology. You know, I mean, it was like a weakness, you know, and Ernie Els needs this kind of stuff or whatever, you know. And of course, now, gosh, I mean, you can hardly, every telecast, I'd say the communications from the analyst and the play-by-play, not the play-by-play, but the analyst, I would think 80% of it is the mental game.
Yeah.
You know, and I've always felt the mental game and the physical are 50-50. In other words, you don't want to blame your physical game on the mental. You know, and the mental is not going to save you from a poor physical game. Sometimes you've got work to do on your physical game. But it's not 100% mental, like, you know, like Raymond Floyd said. Raymond Floyd said, "I think the game's 100% mental," you know. But it is certainly hugely mental. And like you said, I think golf is more mental than most of the other games.
Let's talk about some of your books here. We'll start with The Putting Machine here. I'm one of the worst putters in the country. In fact, I get to, if I'll play in a tournament, I know sometimes I'll just tell myself, but walking up to the ball, I'm not going to make this. I imagine that's not a very good approach to have. You want to feel like you can put it in the hole. But I mean, you know, talking about putting and how much that is a challenge for a lot of people. And, you know, with all the different kinds of putters you can have and your approach, how would you instruct somebody, just an amateur, like how to approach putting? And this is more about, I would say, lag putting. You're talking about long distance type putting.
I don't put myself forth as a putting teacher for sure. I'm not even a great putter myself, but this doesn't have anything to do with that. This was developed by an engineer who came up with a mathematical formula for how far to take your backstroke to be able to hit very specific distances on the green. So therefore, I can't go through the whole procedure, but it's more than just 1 inch for every 10 feet. You know, it actually is an exponential function. And then I took it to a mathematical friend of mine, and he looked at the distribution of putts. If you hit 13 putts with a 4-inch, 5-inch, 6-inch, 7-inch backstroke, and he came up with another formula. The point is, there is a physics and math to how far the ball will go if you've got a consistent stroke and you take a different length backstroke. And that's what this book is all about. It presents this one formula. But it's been presenting, I actually developed a machine with 3D printing where it's a putting machine, I call it, and I call the book a putting machine. And I didn't want to try to demonstrate this because I knew I wouldn't be perfect, but I wanted a perfect machine that I could pull it back 14 inches, 15 inches, 16 inches, and it would be emotionless, you know, hit the ball. It's beautiful to see the distribution of putts when you do that. So that's what that book's all about.
You know, some of the better putters that teach it are Brad Faxon, Steve Stricker. Talk maybe a little bit about Scotty Scheffler, because I think it was well publicized in the last year or 6 months that, you know, he really struggled with his putting. And then Rory suggested, which is rare to hear a player say, hey, this player should try this, with a mallet putter. And then now he's, you know, sinking putts like crazy. He's a favorite to win the Masters.
Yeah, well, he's favored to win everything. And I think he's the new assassin out there, in effect. And I don't know if you remember Earl saying about Tiger, he said he's a nice kid, but when he's on the golf course, he's an assassin.
Yeah.
And I was marveling at Scotty Scheffler the other day, who came back in the tournament, and he was up against a guy who hadn't won in 134 starts or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't help but think, gosh, he's got to be a little sympathetic toward this guy. I mean, but there didn't look like there was any sympathy in his face. And when he missed that 6-foot putt on the last hole, he wasn't happy.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like, oh, I'm glad you won or anything. I mean, there's no way, but he's a nice guy. And I mean, I think that's the new element that he's bringing. He's a wonderful guy, family man. You know, he's not boastful, but he's serious and intense. And he's going to be the real thing, I think.
I think part of what players today kind of deal with, and you could speak to this from having 50 years of experience, where social media was nowhere around, and we were talking about Scotty Scheffler, and he's like, when I'm done, I am not on social media. I don't focus on Twitter. I don't care. I'm with my family, with my kids. You know, so is it seems like a pretty good approach.
I mean,
to kind of separate the game from his personal life.
Yeah, I think if you start reading too much about yourself, you know, you're going to have trouble. I boxed a little in college, and the third year I was in the finals, and in the Notre Dame magazine they had predictions, and so I read my prediction, and I told one of my psychology professors, who happened to be a crew guy, in at least through the Olympic trials or something, so he knew sports, and he said, "Oh no, you shouldn't have read that." And sure enough, I went out. They said Dorsal will come out strong in the first round, and then he'll lose it in the last two rounds. And that's exactly what happened. I probably shouldn't have read that.
You've got a couple other books here, The Complete Golfer. And what does this book talk about?
Well, that book is I drew on all my articles from Golf Week and Golf Magazine. And then I filled in all the gaps to make it a complete golfer book, because the publisher wanted me to write on not only the mental game but the physical game. So that book, the first five chapters are on the physical game. I mean, I start off with, this is the tee, this is the fairway, this is the green. So it's a great book for beginners. And then the second half is just pure mental that would be good for beginner to pro. And they were all originally published by me in Golf Week or Golf Magazine. This other book, Golf the Mental Game, is all my articles put in logical order from Golf Illustrated over a 12-year. They were written over a 12-year period, but here they are organized into a logical sequence that you can use as a reference book, because you can jump in anywhere you want because they were all independent articles at one time.
Right.
And so therefore, this is my legacy, I think, this book here. But this book is good too, and I'm thinking about trying to do a second edition of it, because it ought to be brought back, I would think.
I see one here on part three of the book, Golf the Mental Game, pressure and choking, 6 ways to prevent choking. So you go right after it. It's like, well, you know, who's going to choke? Why? How do you not choke?
Oh Lord, I'd have to look at my own writing there to remember the 6. You know, but I can tell you one thing, it's going to be routine, you know.
Yeah.
In other words, you have got to, I remember, well, I when I'm really tense, I do two things. I try to relax as much as I can, and that's a learned skill itself that psychologists teach, how to get yourself to relax in the moment.
And Jack would do that. Jack would, like, take a deep breath before he pulled the trigger, relax his shoulders, which relax your arms, which relaxes your hands.
Yeah,
and
I would try to mainly focus on my hands. Get a light grip, hard, and then just keep your head down. That's the only thing I think about. One time I was playing in the Senior Open qualifier. It happened to be at my club. That was the only reason I was playing it, really. And I was coming up the 18th, and there I saw the TV cameras behind the green. And I thought, gosh, you know what they're going to do? They're going to put me on local television and say, local sports psychologist. I said, okay, also, nobody's going to see where this shot goes, so just look good, you know. So I said, it was like an 8-iron into the green, so I just got relaxed. I kept my head down, and I looked good. I didn't know where it went. I knew nobody else knew where it went. And I got, you know, I hit a very good shot, you know, doing that. So sometimes I've done that. It's been my mental thought. It's just look good. Make the swing look good.
Okay.
You know, and that's a pretty simple thought. If you make a swing that looks good, it probably is good,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you'll probably get a good result.
You have transitioned from Hilton Head to Pinehurst. What made you, what's your history in Pinehurst, or what made you want to have a residence here as well?
Well, the first time I came here was 1964 with my dad.
Hmm.
And Pinehurst number 5 had just opened.
Okay.
And so we played number 2. Yeah, we played everything. And I came back in 1967 with a college buddy. And we stayed at Holly Inn, and we played 36 holes a day. We walked all the time, played number 2 twice, stayed at the Holly Inn for 2 nights, had all the meals over there, and we were burned out. We meant to stay for 5 days, and we said, we got to go. We can't play anymore. And we said, how much is it? They said $46.
Oh, my goodness.
It was $46 for all that golf, all that food, and 2 nights lodging. At Holly Inn. So anyway,
things have changed.
Yes. So anyway, that was the beginning, and then we moved to Florence, South Carolina. I was at Francis Marion University for 22 years.
Okay.
And so we came up a lot from there. So I was always in touch with Pinehurst.
Mm-hmm.
But recently, realizing all that's happening up here, I thought that I better get in there if I'm going to get in there. And back in around 2011, we were just 6 months out of being charter members at Pine Needles Mid Pines, and we're members there for 2 years, but then moving to Hilton Head and everything, I let that go. But now I wanted to get back in, and we thought we'd try the other end of Highway 2 and try Pinehurst. So we bought a place in the village over there and joined Pinehurst Country Club.
You picked a great time to come to Pinehurst.
It is
absolutely right. As we record this earlier today, was the opening of Pinehurst number 10. It's a spectacular Tom Doak design. Angela Moser turned a lot of the earth out there. It's going to be a spectacular addition. You've got some broadcasting background as well. You actually were in the booth as we get ready for the U.S. Open here. NBC will cover that, and that would be Dan Hicks and company from NBC Sports. But you were in the booth with Dick Emberg and Johnny Miller at the Bay Hill Invitational. Talk about what that experience was like.
Well, believe it or not, that was the tournament that Dan Hicks was just breaking in.
Okay.
They were just bringing him on. And also Gary Koch was very new at that
Better
tournament.
Than most.
Yeah. And they're still there. Of course, I was just visiting. But there were some interesting experiences there going over. Bob Trumpy, who was in the 13th hour, I went around with him for a day, and he took me over to the cabin, Arnold Palmer's cabin. But on Sunday, I was up in the booth with Dick Enberg and Johnny Miller. And prior to that, Johnny Miller took me around all day. But the funniest thing about that was, and what people don't realize is, those guys up in the booth can't see the whole 18 holes. They're looking at 3 television monitors, at least they were back then.
Or producers telling them,
and
this is what's coming up.
Yeah, and producers and staff are handing Dick Enberg notes because he's very intently focused on the content.
Mm-hmm.
And So he was wound up tighter than a drum, but Johnny Miller was looser than a goose, and he didn't have any notes, and he was just commenting on anything he wanted. And the funny thing was, they had me sit over by the monitors. I was like a fourth monitor, you know, and I was the only one up there spectating, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I had to sit there for 3 hours. They said, you can sit here, but don't move. So I sat there for 3 hours, and Johnny Miller, every time he'd say something funny, he'd look at me to see if it was funny or not, you know? And I thought, oh my gosh, I better laugh or he'll lose his confidence, you know? But I felt kind of on the spot up there.
Any future books in mind? I know you have the latest one, 2008. Well, you work on anything right now?
Well, I'm just writing a lot of little articles. I write a column for the Florence Morning News, and periodically it'll be a golf column. I write regularly, kind of anytime I want, for Junior Golf USA, which is a wonderful junior golf website. Or I don't know, it's a podcast, I guess. No, it's not that. It's a blog, I guess, you know, where everything's junior golf, and I write for them. And then I'll write occasionally for the paper in Hilton Head, you know, something on golf. But I, you know, the magazines have dried up. I mean, there's just no way to get into the magazines. Writing another book, what I'd really rather do is take my first book and do a second edition, which would require very little, because the only thing I'd really change is the equipment chapter, because equipment has changed enormously. I mean, when I wrote that book in 1996, metal drivers were just coming out.
Yeah.
You know, so that would take a total workover. And I might like to get somebody with a little more authority on the physical game of golf than me to take a part in a second edition and take me off the hook there. The only reason I wrote about the physical side, which I could do, and I wrote it at a very basic level, was because the publisher required that, because they wanted to use the book for PE classes and it wanted to be at a complete golf book.
What about your golf game?
My golf game, when I, you know, I never won anything big. I won small tournaments. I got my game down to, well, let me tell you this. Somebody challenged me one time in a talk and said, hey, if you're so smart in sports psychology, why aren't you a better golfer? So I told
Makes
him,
sense.
I said, you know, I mean, just like a doctor, I mean, you might know everything about medicine, but you may be unavoidably unhealthy, you know, because of, I mean, I just don't have quite the body, the skill, the talent of, you know, a great golfer. But I mean, I was playing at like about a 7 handicap. And I thought, you know, I'm going to see if I can make my game better deliberately with this stuff. So I came up with a number of things that I was going to do over the next 5 months, and I was going to record where I started and where I ended. Well, when I started, I was 7.1 handicap, and this was in March, 7.1 handicap, and I was winning 44% of my matches. And I had started a challenge ladder at the club, and I played matches all the time, and I was winning 44%. After 5 months of my deliberate effort and what I was trying to do, I lowered my handicap to 4.1, and my winning percentage went up to 88%. And Golf Illustrated took that data and they put it on the cover of their magazine. My handicap going from 7.1 each month down is on the cover of one of the Golf Illustrated issues. And so anyway, that's the level I play. And I still play. I still work at it. I still experiment out there on all kinds of things. But, you know, there is the limits of age. But in some ways, I'm hitting it better now than I was 5 years ago.
Mm. What about this U.S. Open coming up? You've played Pinehurst number 2 before. It's changed quite a bit. It's going to be a real test. How would you... to say for somebody approaching U.S. Open, what would be the best mental approach?
You know, that's interesting. I have been wanting to get press credentials and be able to ask as many players as I could politely ask, what is the key mental thing you would tell everybody that has got you to the U.S. Open? And then I'd love to write an extensive article on that. I don't know. I'd like to know, you know, I mean, exactly what they're thinking, because I don't know that it would be any different than your mental approach to excelling at golf at any level, but I'd like to know the special things that they think were the most important. Now, you can tell yourself, and one thing I have said to people when you're really under pressure in a big tournament is, this is just practice for for something that's going to be bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you don't get a whole lot bigger than the U.S. Open, but if you could say when you got that big putt on the last hole, I could have this for the Ryder Cup, you know, so this is great opportunity to practice when I've got this putt for the Ryder Cup. Now, you're fooling yourself a little bit because you'd love to just win the U.S. Open, you know, but if somehow you can take a little of the weight off of that specific putt by saying that this is not the end all, there mm-hmm. is still bigger to go. And that's one thing I would think for a big tournament. But that could be the club championship, too.
Yeah. I got to tell you, you got to admire these players because, I mean, you know, I've played TPC Sawgrass before. And, yeah, when you're there with a buddy and you're playing that 17th hole, that island hole, yeah, I've hit the green before and I parred that hole. But I didn't have to hit that shot in front of 20,000 people at the stadium either. So, you know, it's a lot to it's amazing how much the mental game plays a part in the game. You got to have the skill. Yeah. But if you don't have between the ears, you're not going to be on the level of a Tiger or a Wyndham Clark or Scottie Scheffler.
Well, that reminds me, though, you just made me think of something there that – you've got to get into your cocoon, whether you're out there by yourself or there's 20,000 people, you know. So therefore, you've got to, like Ben Hogan said, he was walking to the practice range one day and a lady asked him for an autograph. He said, "Excuse me, madam, but I'm already playing my round." So he was already in his
right.
cocoon.
Yeah.
And so therefore, I would suggest to somebody, just like I suggested to the player that called me the other day, get a simple game plan. Go out and recommit to it on each hole. Don't worry about the 72nd hole on Sunday. Worry about the hole you're on mm-hmm. right now. Execute that game plan. When you get finished with the round, count how many holes did I execute the game plan on, you know, and see if you can do better the next day. And maybe by the fourth round, you'll be focused enough to do it on all of them.
Well, it's great advice, and we appreciate you taking time to pop into Paradise in the Pines. I know we all deal with the mental side of the game, whether it be amateur who's a 3, 10 handicap, 20 handicap, or a PGA touring professional. It's something we all deal with and always will, and that's why there's going to be people like you having jobs and writing articles all the time. Tom Dorsal, Dr. Tom Dorsal, I appreciate your time. And
thank you.
And we'll see you soon in Pinehurst. I know where to find you. So when I'm dealing with the mental stuff, I'll be sure to contact you for sure. And reminder, the three books, The Putting Machine by Tom Dorsal, The Complete Golfer, and also the latest one from 2008, Golf, The Mental Game. Dr. Dorsal, appreciate your time. And we'll see you hopefully on the golf course.
Oh, thank you. I hope so.
Well, if you want to learn more about tourism and this destination, the home of American golf, go to homeofgolf.com. If you want to watch these videos, go to our YouTube channel, which is Home of American Golf. And if you want to download this podcast, just search Paradise in the Pines. We'll see you next time.